terrible pain. I remember thinking death would be welcome. I was so sick of living, sick of my life, sick of the miserable person I was. I knew that if I survived, and one day got paroled again, I'd end up on the streets, playing the same game. Where I grew up, you either went to prison, or you died young. Sounds very different from the way you grew up, doesn't it, Baxter? He shrugged. In many ways it is. In many ways it is not. My life was all about myself, much like yours. I loved the bad things, just like you. Pleasure, selfishness, pride. That was my life. And it's been yours, I suppose. Oh, yes. It's all sin. And it all leads to the same end. Misery, pain, destruction, ruin, then death. That's where you're headed, son. And you're in a hurry to get there. Baxter nodded slightly.
So what happened?
I got lucky and lived. And not long afterward, I met an inmate. A career criminal who would never be eligible for parole. And he was the gentlest, sweetest, happiest person I'd ever talked to. Had no worries. Every day was beautiful. Life was grand. And this from a man who'd spent 15 years in max security. Through a prison ministry, he'd been exposed to the gospel of Christ. And he became a believer. He said he was praying for me, as he prayed for a lot of the bad guys in prison. He invited me to a Bible study one night, and I listened to other inmates tell their stories and praise God for his forgiveness and love and strength and promise of eternal salvation. Imagine, a bunch of hardened criminals locked away in a rotten prison singing songs of praise to their Lord. Pretty powerful stuff. And I needed some of it. I needed forgiveness, because there were lots of sins in my past. I needed peace. Because I'd been at war my entire life. I needed love, because I hated everybody. I needed strength, because deep inside, I knew how weak I was. I needed happiness, because I'd been miserable for so long. So we prayed together, me and those bad boys who were like little lambs. And I confessed to God that I was a sinner, and that I wanted salvation through Jesus Christ. My life changed in an instant, Baxter. A change so overwhelming I still can't believe it. The Holy Spirit entered my soul, and the old Manny Lucera died. A new one was born, one whose past was forgiven, and his eternity secured.
What about the drugs?
Forgotten. The power of the Holy Spirit is far greater than human desire. I've seen it 1,000 times with addicts who try everything to quit. Rehab clinics, state facilities, shrinks and doctors, fancy meds sold as substitutes. When you're an addict, you're powerless in the face of booze and drugs. Strength comes from somewhere else. For me, it comes from the power of the Holy Spirit.
I don't feel very strong right now.
You're not. Look at yourself. From Washoe Retreat to a cheap bar in a rundown casino in a few hours. That might be a record, Baxter.
I didn't want to go to that bar.
Of course not. But you did.
Why?
His voice was soft, fading. Because you've never said no. A tear rolled down Baxter's cheek, and he wiped it with the back of his hand.
I don't want to go back to L.A.
You can't, son.
Can you help me? I'm pretty shaky here, okay? I mean, I'm really scared.
Let's pray together, Baxter.
I'll try.
Chapter 19. 6 months after the Trilon-Barton dispute went public with the filing of the lawsuit, the battleground had been defined, and the troops were in place. Both sides had filed ponderous motions designed to capture the higher ground, but so far no advantage had been gained. They were, of course, haggling over deadlines, schedules, issues, discovery, and who got to see what documents and when. With the waves of lawyers working in sync, the case was plodding along. A trial was nowhere in sight, but then it was far too early. With monthly billings to Trilon averaging $5.5 million, why push the case to a conclusion? On the other side, Barton Dynamics was paying just as much for a vigorous and gold-plated defense coordinated by the bare-knuckle litigators at AG Poe and Epps. Ape had committed 40 lawyers to the case, and, like Scully, had such a deep bench that it could send in another wave whenever necessary. The hottest issue so far was no surprise to either set of litigators. When the forced marriage of Trilon and Barton unraveled, when their clumsy joint venture blew up, there had been a virtual slugfest for the documents. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of documents had been generated during the development of the B-10 hypersonic bomber. Researchers employed by Trilon grabbed all the documents they could. Researchers for Barton did the same. Software was routed and rerouted, and some of it was destroyed. Hardware controlled by one company found its way to the other. Thousands of secured files disappeared. Crates of printed documents were hoarded and hidden. And throughout the melee, each company accused the other of lying, espionage, outright thievery. When the dust settled, neither knew exactly what the other possessed. Because of the super-sensitive nature of the research, the Pentagon watched in horror as the two companies behaved outrageously. The Pentagon, as well as several intelligence agencies, leaned heavily on Trilon and Barton to keep their dirty laundry private, but they were ultimately not successful. The fight was now controlled by the lawyers and the courts. A major task for Mr. Wilson Rush and his Scully and Pershing team was to accumulate, index, copy, and store all documents in the possession of Trilon. A warehouse was leased in Wilmington, North Carolina, about a mile from the Trilon testing facility where most of the B-10 research had taken place. After it was leased, it was completely renovated and made fire, wind, and waterproof. All windows were removed and replaced with a 6-inch cinder block wall. A Washington security firm wired the warehouse with 20 closed-circuit cameras. The four large doors were equipped with infrared alarms and metal detectors. Armed guards patrolled the empty warehouse long before any of the documents arrived. When they did arrive, they came in unmarked tractor-trailer rigs, complete with more armed guards. Dozens of deliveries were made over a 2-week period in mid-September. The warehouse, nicknamed Fort Rush, came to life as ton after ton of paperwork was stacked neatly in white cardboard boxes, all waiting to be organized into a system understood only by the lawyers up in New York. The warehouse was leased by Scully and Pershing. Every contract was signed by Wilson Rush. Contracts for the renovations, security operations, transporting of documents, everything. Once the documents entered the warehouse, they were deemed AWP, attorney's work product, and thus subject to a different set of rules regarding disclosure to the other side. Mr. Rush selected 10 associates from his litigation team, 10 of the brightest and most trusted. These unlucky souls were shipped to Wilmington and introduced to Fort Rush, a long, windowless hangar of a building with shiny concrete floors and a pungent industrial smell to it. In the center was the mountain of boxes. Along both sides were rows of empty folding tables, and beyond the tables were 10 large, fierce-looking copy machines, with wires and cables running everywhere. The copiers were, of course, state-of-the-art color, and capable of instant scanning, collating, even stapling. Far away from their New York offices, the associates were allowed to wear jeans and running shoes, and they were promised bigger bonuses and other goodies. But nothing could compensate them for the dismal job of physically copying and scanning 1 million documents. And in Wilmington, most were married, with spouses and children back home, though of the 10, 4 had already suffered through a divorce. And it was quite likely that Fort Rush would be the cause of even more marital problems. They began their forbidding task under the direction of Mr. Rush himself. Every document was copied twice, in a split second, and instantly scanned into the firm's virtual library. Several weeks down the road, when the task was complete, the library would be accessible by a secured code, and once inside, a lawyer could locate any document in a matter of seconds. The firm's computer experts designed the library, and were supremely confident that its security was impenetrable. To impress upon the associates the gravity of their seemingly mindless work, Mr. Rush stayed for 3 days and was involved in the unpacking, sorting, scanning, copying, and repacking. When he left, Two other litigation partners remained and directed traffic. Such mundane work was normally contracted out to a copying service and supervised by the firm's litigation support staff, but that was far too risky with these documents. They had to be handled by real lawyers who appreciated their importance. The real lawyers manning the copiers averaged about $400,000 in salary, and most had at least one degree from an Ivy League school. At no point in their graduate or postgraduate studies could they have pictured themselves running copiers, but after 4 or 5 years with Scully and Pershing, they were shockproof. The rotation began after the first week. 8 days in the warehouse, then 4 days in New York, then back to Wilmington. The assignments were staggered, and a total of 15 associates were eventually used. All were forbidden to discuss any aspect of Fort Rush with anyone in New York. Security and confidentiality were paramount. The first project took 6 weeks. 2.2 million documents were copied, indexed, and added to the library. The associates were freed from Fort Rush and flown back to New York on a chartered jet. By then, Benny knew exactly where the warehouse was located and had a general idea of its security features, but his interest in these matters was only passing. What Benny wanted, of course, was access to the virtual library. Access only his spy could deliver. Chapter 20. For another $1,000, the security firm in Pittsburgh watched Elaine Keenan long enough to determine her daily routine. She usually had lunch with some co-workers at a sandwich shop not far from the Parks and Recreation Complex where she worked. A chance encounter would have to be believable, and Joey couldn't sell the idea of bumping into her in the lesbian bar she and her roommate occasionally frequented. He wasn't sure he could sell any encounter with Elaine. Aside from the casual sex 5.5 years earlier, he'd never really known her. She had been one of several groupies around the Beta fraternity, and he tried to forget all of them. The security firm provided 3 color photos. Joey had studied them for hours and was not convinced he'd ever met the girl. Kyle, however, had studied them and claimed to recall her vividly. Now, at the age of 23, her dark hair was tinted a deep red and worn very short. There was no makeup, no lipstick, nothing but matching tattoos around her forearms. If she had any interest in being attractive, it was not apparent. Somewhere under all the attitude was a cute girl, but sex appeal was unimportant. Joey swallowed hard, cursed Kyle again, and entered the sandwich shop. He eased behind her as she waited in line to order, and after a few minutes, as the line moved slowly forward, managed to bump into her. "Sorry," he quickly said with a wide, fake smile. She smiled back, but said nothing. He moved a step closer and said, "Hey, you were at Duquesne a few years ago, weren't you?" Her 2 co-workers glanced back, but were not interested. "Briefly," she said, eyeing him carefully, searching for any clue. He snapped his fingers as if trying to recall something. "Elaine, right? Can't think of the last name." "That's right. And who are you?" "Joey Bernardo. I was in Beta." A look of horror swept over her face, and she dropped her gaze to the floor. For a moment she was frozen, unable to speak, ready, it seemed, to erupt. Then she shuffled a step to keep pace in line. She turned her back on the man who once raped her, a man who walked away from the crime not only unpunished, but completely vindicated. Joey watched her from the corner of an eye and felt uneasy for several reasons. First, she was obviously frightened by him, but since she considered herself the victim and him the rapist, this was not surprising. It was also uncomfortable being this close to someone he'd once had sex with, regardless of how casual or how uneventful it now seemed. She turned halfway to him and hissed,
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm eating lunch, same as you."
"Would you please leave?"
Her voice was barely audible, but one of her co-workers turned around and glared at Joey.
"No, I'm just getting a sandwich."
Nothing else was said as they ordered and moved down to the pickup counter. Elaine hurried off to a distant table and ate quickly with her 2 friends. Joey ate alone at a small table near the front door. The note was already prepared. It read, "Elaine, I'd like to talk to you about what happened. Please call my cell at 412-866-0940. I'll be in Scranton until 9 o'clock tomorrow. Joey Bernardo. He hauled his tray back to the counter, then walked to her table, handed her the note without a word, and disappeared. 2 hours later, she called. At 5 p.m. sharp, as agreed, Joey returned to the sandwich shop. He found Elaine at the same table she'd used for lunch, but instead of sitting with a couple of friends, she was accompanied by her attorney. Icy introductions were made, and Joey sat down across from them with a knot in his throat and a strong desire to maim Kyle McAvoy. Where the hell was Kyle anyway? He was the lawyer. Elaine's lawyer was an attractive, middle-aged woman. Everything was black: pantsuit, thick coral necklace, boots, eyeshadow, and, worst of all, her mood. This woman went for the throat. The business card Joey was holding and glancing at proclaimed her to be Michelin Mike Chiz, attorney and counselor at law. She began matter-of-factly. "My first question for you, Mr. Bernardo, is what are you doing here?"
"How many questions do you have?"
Joey asked in his finest smart-ass manner. He had been assured time after time by his pseudo-lawyer and near-co-defendant, one Kyle McAvoy, that there was no danger in this chance meeting with Elaine Keenan. Any legal action she wanted to initiate could have been commenced long ago. 5.5 years had passed.
"Well, Mr. Bernardo, may I call you Joey?"
There was almost no chance that she would allow him to call her Mike, so he abruptly said no.
"Very well, Mr. Bernardo. I have just a few questions. I have represented Ms. Keenan here for some time now. She actually works part-time in my office, a fine paralegal, and I'm familiar with her story. Now, what are you doing here?"
"First of all, I don't have to explain a damned thing to you, but I'll try to be nice, at least for the next 60 seconds. I work for a brokerage firm in Pittsburgh, and we have some clients in Scranton. I'm here to see these clients. I got hungry around noon today. I chose this 4-star restaurant at random. Walked in, saw Ms. Keenan here, said hello, she freaked, I wanted to chat, and now I'm taking questions from her lawyer. Why exactly do you need a lawyer, Elaine?"
"You raped me, Joey," Elaine blurted. "You and Baxter Tate, and maybe Kyle McAvoy."
By the time she finished, her eyes were moist. Her breathing was heavy, almost heaving, as if she might lunge at him at any moment.
"Maybe this, maybe that. You never got your story straight."
"Why did you want to talk to my client?"
Ms. Chiz demanded.
"Because it was a misunderstanding, and I wanted to apologize for the misunderstanding, that's all. After she cried rape, we never saw her again. The cops investigated, found nothing because nothing happened, and by then Elaine had disappeared."
"You raped me, Joey, and you know it."
"There was no rape, Elaine. We had sex. Me and you, you and Baxter, you and most of the other boys at Beta, but it was all very consensual."
Elaine closed her eyes and began shaking as if chills swept her body.
"Why does she need a lawyer?" Joey asked Ms. Chiz.
"She's suffered greatly."
"I don't know how much she's suffered, Ms. Chiz, but I do know that she suffered very little during her days at Duquesne. She was too busy partying to spend time suffering. Lots of booze, drugs, and sex, and there are lots of boys and girls perfectly capable of refreshing her memory. You better get to know your client before you pursue some bogus legal action. There's a lot of bad stuff back there."
"Shut up!"
Elaine snarled.
"You want to apologize to her?"
the lawyer said.
"Yes. Elaine, I apologize for the misunderstanding, whatever the hell it was. And I think you should apologize for accusing us of something that did not happen. And right now, I want to apologize for even being here."
Joey sprang to his feet.
"This was not a good idea. So long."
He walked quickly out of the deli, strolled to his car, and left Scranton. Driving back to Pittsburgh, when he wasn't cursing Kyle McAvoy, he was hearing her voice again and again.
"You raped me, Joey."
Her words were painful and free of doubt.
She may not have known precisely what happened in their apartment 5.5 years earlier, but she certainly knew now. He hadn't raped anyone.
What began as consensual sex, at her suggestion,
nonetheless, had now been transformed into something far different, at least in her mind. If a girl consents to sex, can she change her mind once things are underway? Or if she consents to sex, then blacks out halfway through the act, how can she later claim she'd changed her mind? Difficult questions, and Joey wrestled with them as he drove.
You raped me, Joey.
The mere accusation carried a heavy dose of suspicion, and for the first time, Joey questioned himself. Had he and Baxter taken advantage of her?
4 days later, Kyle stopped by the mailroom at Scully and Pershing and picked up a letter from Joey. It was a detailed summary of the encounter, complete with their choice of sandwiches and a description of Elaine's hair color and matching tattoos. After setting out the facts, Joey offered his opinions.
EK has definitely convinced herself that she was raped by several of us, JB and BT for sure, and maybe KM. She is weak, fragile, emotionally unstable, haunted, but at the same time carries a certain smugness in her victimhood. She has chosen the right attorney, a tough broad who believes in her and would not hesitate to start legal trouble if she could find any evidence. Her finger's on the trigger. If that little video is half as damaging as you say it is, then by all human means, keep it locked away from these people. Elaine and her lawyer are two cobras, pissed and coiled and ready to strike.
He finished with, I'm not sure what my next little project might be, but I'd rather not go near Elaine again. I don't like being called a rapist. The entire episode was unnerving, plus I had to lie to Blair to get out of town. I have 2 tickets to the Steelers-Giants game on October 26th. Shall I call you with this news so your goons will know about it? I really think we should go to the game and hash out our next moves. Your faithful servant, Joey.
Kyle read the letter and summary in the main library while hiding between shelves of ancient law books. It confirmed his worst fears, but he had little time to dwell on it. He quietly tore the sheets of paper into 100 pieces, then dropped them in a wastebasket as he left the library. Immediately destroy all written correspondence, he'd instructed Joey. The hotel nearest his apartment was the Chelsea Garden, a 15-minute walk. At 11 that night, Kyle dragged himself along 7th Avenue, looking for the hotel. Had he not been so exhausted, he might have enjoyed the cool autumn night with leaves sweeping across the sidewalk and half the city still awake and going somewhere. But Kyle was numb with fatigue and capable of only one thought at a time, and that was often too much. Benny was in a suite on the 3rd floor, where he'd been waiting for 2 hours because his asset couldn't get away from the office. But Benny didn't mind. His asset belonged at the office, and the more time he spent there, the quicker Benny could get on with his work. Regardless, though, Benny opened up with a nasty, "You're 2 hours late."
"Sue me,"
Kyle stretched out on the bed. This was their 4th meeting in New York since Kyle had moved there, and he had yet to hand over anything that Benny wasn't supposed to have. His ethics were still intact. No laws had been broken. So why did he feel like such a traitor? Benny was tapping a large white poster board mounted on an easel.
If I could have your attention, please, he said. This won't take long. I have some coffee if you'd like.
Kyle wasn't about to concede an inch. He jumped to his feet, poured coffee in a paper cup, and sat on the edge of the bed.
Go. This is the Trilon team as it is now assembled. At the top here is Wilson Rush, and below him are 8 litigation partners, Mason, Bradley, Weems, Cochran, Green, Abbott, Etheridge, and Wittenberg. How many have you met?
Kyle studied the 8 squares with the name scrawled inside them and thought for a second.
Wilson Rush spoke to us during orientation, but I haven't seen him since. I did a memo for Abbott on a securities case, met him briefly, and I had lunch one day in the cafeteria with Wittenberg. I've seen Bradley, Weems, maybe Etheridge, but I can't say I've met them. It's a big firm.
Kyle was still amazed at the unknown faces he encountered every day in the halls and elevators, the cafeteria and libraries and coffee rooms. He tried to socialize and at least say hello, but the clock was always ticking, and billing was much more important. His supervising partner was Doug Peckham, and he was relieved Peckham's name was not on the board. There were a bunch of smaller squares under the partners. Benny tapped an index finger near them.
There are 16 senior associates, and under them another 16 younger ones. The names are in that binder over there. You need to memorize them.
Sure, Benny.
Kyle glanced at the binder, this one a 2-inch blue one. The last three were black and thicker. Then he studied the names on the board.
How many of these associates have you worked with?
5, 6, maybe 7, he said, with no effort at being accurate. How would Benny know whom he'd worked with? And how Benny knew the names of all 41 lawyers assigned to the Trilon case was a question Kyle didn't even want to consider. A few of the names would appear in the court file, but only the big boys. How many sources did he have?
He pointed to a smaller box.
This is a senior associate named Sherry Abney. You met her?
No.
A rising star, fast-tracked to partnership, 2 degrees from Harvard and a federal clerkship. She reports to partner Mason, who's in charge of discovery. Under her is a second-year associate by the name of Jack McDougal. McDougal has a cocaine problem. No one at the firm knows it, but he's about to get busted, so everybody will know it. His departure will be quick.
Kyle stared at the box with McDougal's name and thought of so many questions he didn't know where to start.
How did Benny know this?
And you want me to take his place?
I want you to schmooze it up with Sherry Abney. Check her out. Get to know her. She's 30 years old, single, but committed to an investment banker at Chase who works as many hours as she does, so they have no time for any fun. No wedding date, as of now, at least nothing that has been announced. She likes to play squash when she can find the time, and as you know, the firm has 2 courts on the 40th floor beside the gym. You play squash?
I guess I do now.
Kyle had played several times at Yale.
Not sure when I'll find the time.
You figure it out. She just might be your entree onto the Trilon team.
Go, team, go.
Kyle planned to avoid Trilon and its litigation team as diligently as possible.
Small problem here, Benny, Kyle said. Nice homework, but you're missing the obvious. There are no first-year grunts anywhere near this case.
A couple of reasons. First, we don't know anything. 5 months ago, we were still in law school. And second, the smart boys at Trilon probably told their lawyers to keep the rookies away from this case. That happens, you know. Not all of our clients are stupid enough to pay $300 an hour for a bunch of kids to stick it to them. So, Benny, where's Plan B?
It takes patience, Kyle. And politics. You start angling for the Trilon case, networking with the upper associates, kissing the right asses, and we might get a lucky break.
Kyle wasn't finished with the discussion about McDougal. He was determined to pursue it, when another man suddenly appeared from the sitting room adjacent to the bedroom. Kyle was so startled he almost dropped the half-filled cup of coffee.
This is Nigel, Benny was saying. He'll spend a few minutes on systems.
Nigel was in his face, thrusting forward a hand to shake.
A pleasure,
he sang in a cheery British way. He then moved to the tripod and mounted his own display. The sitting room was 12 by 12. Kyle looked through the open double doors into it. Nigel had been hiding in there and listening to every word.
Scully and Pershing uses a litigation support system called Jurybox, he began quickly.
All movements were rapid and precise. British, but with a strange accent. 40 years old, 5 feet 10 inches, 150 pounds. Short, dark hair, half gray. Eyes, brown. No remarkable features, but slightly elevated cheekbones. Thin lips. No eyeglasses.
How much have they taught you about jury books?
Nigel wanted to know.
The basics? I've used it on several occasions.
Kyle was still reeling from Nigel's unexpected appearance.
It's your typical litigation support system. All discovery is scanned into a virtual library that can be accessed by all lawyers working on the case. Quick retrieval of documents. Super quick search of keywords, phrases, contract language. Anything, really. You're up to speed?
Yes.
It's fairly secure. Pretty standard stuff these days. And like all smart law firms, Scully also uses a more secure system for sensitive files and cases. It's called Bannister. You in on this one?
No.
Not surprised. They keep it quiet. Works pretty much like Jurybox, but much harder to access or to hack into. Keep your ears open for it.
Kyle nodded as if he would do precisely as he was being told. Since February, on that awful night when he'd been ambushed after a youth league basketball game on the cold streets of New Haven, he had met only with Benny Wright, or whoever he really was. He had assumed, without really thinking about it, that Benny, as his handler, would be the only face of the operation. There were other faces, to be sure. In particular, a couple of the street pounders who followed him night and day and who'd made enough mistakes so that Kyle could now spot them. But it had not occurred to him that he would actually be introduced to someone else with a bogus name who worked for the operation. And why was he? Benny was certainly capable of handling Nigel's little presentation.
"And then you have the Trilon case,"
Nigel was singing.
"A completely different matter, I'm afraid. Much more complicated and secure. Whole different batch of software, really. Probably written just for this one lawsuit. Got the docs locked up in a warehouse down south with Uzis at every door. But we've made progress."
He stopped long enough to allow himself a quick approving smile at Benny. "Aren't we clever?"
"We know that the program is codenamed Sonic, as in B-10 Hypersonic Bomber."
"Not very creative, if you ask me. But then they didn't, did they?
Sonic cannot be accessed by the nice little laptop they gave you greenies on day one.
No, sir.
No laptop can have a peek at Sonic."
Nigel bounced to the other side of the tripod.
"There is a secret room on the 18th floor of your building. Heavily secured, mind you, with a bank of desktop computers, some really fancy stuff. And there is where you will find Sonic. Passcodes change every week. Passwords every day. Sometimes twice a day. Must have the proper ID before logging in, and if you log out without quitting to a T, they'll write you up and maybe show you the door."
"Show me the door," Kyle almost said.
"Sonic is probably a bastardized version of Barrister, so it will be incumbent upon you to master Barrister as soon as you're given the opportunity."
"Can't wait," Kyle almost said. Slowly, through the shock and the fatigue, it was sinking in that Kyle was crossing the line, and doing it in a way he had not envisioned. His nightmare was to walk out of Scully and Pershing with secrets he was not supposed to have, and deliver them like Judas to Benny for 30 pieces of silver. Now, though, he was receiving firm secrets from an outside source. He had yet to steal anything, but he damned sure wasn't supposed to know about Sonic and the hidden room on the 18th floor. Perhaps it wasn't criminal, and maybe it wasn't a violation of the canons of ethics, but it certainly felt wrong.
"That's enough for now," Benny was saying. "You look exhausted. Get some rest."
"Oh, thank you." Back on 7th Avenue, Kyle glanced at his watch. It was almost midnight. Chapter 21. At 5 a.m., the usual hour now, the alarm clock exploded at full volume, and Kyle slapped it twice before it shut off. He hurried through the shower and the shave, and 15 minutes later he was on the sidewalk, fashionably dressed because he could certainly afford fine clothes. His life had quickly become a harried, fatigued mess, but he was determined to look nice as he stumbled through the day. He bought a coffee, a bagel, and a copy of the Times at his favorite all-night deli, then caught a cab at the corner of 24th and 7th. 10 minutes later, he'd finished breakfast, scanned the newspaper, and gulped half the coffee. He walked into the Broad Street entrance of his office building at 6 o'clock, on schedule. Regardless of the hour, he was never alone during the elevator ride up. There were usually two or three other bleary-eyed and gaunt-faced associates, all sleep-deprived, all avoiding eye contact as the elevator hummed and rocked gently upward, and they asked themselves several questions. What was I thinking when I chose law school? How long will I last in this meat grinder? What fool designed this method of practicing law? There was seldom a word because there was nothing to say. Like prisoners riding to the gallows, they chose to meditate and put things in perspective. At the Cube, Kyle was not surprised to see another young lawyer. Tim Reynolds had been the first to sneak in a sleeping bag, a new, thermally insulated Eddie Bauer special that he claimed he'd owned for years and taken all over the country. But it had a new smell to it. Tim, without shoes, tie, shirt, or jacket, and wearing an old T-shirt, was partially curled under his small desk, inside the sleeping bag, dead to the world. Kyle kicked his feet, woke him up, and began with a pleasant, "You look like crap."
"Good morning,"
Tim said, scrambling to his feet and reaching for his shoes.
"What time is it?"
6:10.
"What time did you go to sleep?"
"I don't remember. Sometime after 2. He was pulling on his shirt quickly, as if a dreaded partner might appear any second and issue demerits.
"I have a memo due for Toby Rowland at 7, and I have no idea what I'm doing."
"Just keep billing," Kyle said without a trace of sympathy as he unpacked his briefcase and pulled out his laptop. Tim finished dressing and grabbed a file.
"I'll be in the library," he said, already a wreck.
"Don't forget to brush your teeth," Kyle said. When Reynolds was gone, Kyle went online to a website called quickface.com. There were several sites that allowed amateur sleuths to put together composite sketches of faces, and Kyle had studied them all. Quickface was by far the most detailed and accurate. He began with Nigel's eyes, always the most important feature. Get the eyes right, and half the identification is over. The site offered over 200 different types of eyes, every race, color, origin, and blend. Kyle went through them quickly, found the closest set, and began his face. Nose, thin and pointed. Eyebrows, moderately thick and a bit long down the sides. Lips, very thin. Cheekbones, higher and wider. Chin, not long but very flat, no dimple. Ears, oval and stuck close to the skull. After he added the hair, he went back to the eyes, tried another pair, then another. The ears were too high, so he lowered them. He tinkered and sculpted until 6:30, a half hour unbilled and wasted unless he chose to pad a bit during the day. And when Nigel was properly put together and easily identified from 40 feet away, Kyle printed the face and hustled off to the library, carrying a thick file because everyone carried a thick file into the library. His private spot was a dead end in a dark corner on the third level of stacked tiers, a lonesome place where they stored thick tomes of annotations no one had used in decades. On the second shelf from the bottom, he lifted 3 of the books and removed an unmarked manila envelope, letter-sized. He opened it and pulled out 3 other composites, a splendid rendering of his archenemy Benny and 2 others of the goons who were stalking him around New York City. To his knowledge, he had not been within 50 feet of them and had never made eye contact, but he'd seen both on several occasions and was confident that his artwork was at least a decent starting point. The addition of Nigel's dreadful face to the collection did nothing to improve its overall attractiveness. He hid the envelope and returned to the cube, where Tabor the Gunner was busy making his usual noisy preparations for the day. The issue of whose career held the most promise had been settled weeks earlier. Tabor was the man, the star, the fast-tracked partner-to-be, and everyone else could get out of the way. He'd proven his talents by billing 21 hours in a single day. He'd shown his skill by billing more the first month than all other litigation rookies, though Kyle was only 4 hours behind. He volunteered for projects and worked the cafeteria like an old Irish ward boss. "Slept in the library last night," he said as soon as he saw Kyle.
"Good morning, Tabor."
"The carpet in the main library is thinner than the carpet in the 23rd library. Did you know that, Kyle? I much prefer sleeping on the 23rd, but it does have more noise. Which do you prefer?"
"We're all cracking up, Tabor."
"Yes, we are. Tim used his sleeping bag last night." "For what? He and Dr. Dale finally getting it on?"
"Don't know about that. I woke him up an hour ago."
"So you went home? Slept in your own bed?"
"Oh, yes."
"Well, I have 2 projects due at noon today, both extremely important and urgent, and I can't afford the luxury of sleep."
"You're the greatest, Tabor.
Go Superman."
And with that, Tabor was gone. Dale Armstrong arrived promptly at 7, her usual time, and though she looked a bit sleepy, she was put together as always. Evidently, the bulk of her fat salary was being spent on designer clothing, and Kyle, along with Tim and Tabor, looked forward to the daily fashion statement.
"You look great today," Kyle said with a smile.
"Thank you."
"Prada?"
"Dolce & Gabbana." Killer shoes. Blonix?
Jimmy Choo.
$500?
Don't ask. Admiring her each day, Kyle was quickly learning the names of the high priests of female clothing. It was one of the few topics she cared to discuss. After 6 weeks of shared space in the cube, he still knew very little about her. When she talked, which was not very often, it was always about law firm business and the miserable life of a first-year associate. If there was a boyfriend, he had yet to be mentioned. She had dropped her guard twice and agreed to drinks after work, but she usually declined. And while every rookie was openly grousing about the hours and the pressure, Dale Armstrong seemed to be feeling the strain more than most. "What are you doing for lunch?" Kyle asked. "I haven't had breakfast yet," she replied coolly, and withdrew into her little section of the cube. Chapter 22. The lights in the shelter came on each morning at 6, and most of the homeless awoke and began making preparations for another day. The rules did not allow them to stay past 8 o'clock. Many had jobs, but those who didn't were expected to be on the streets looking for employment. Brother Manny and his staff were very successful in placing their friends, even if the work was often part-time and minimum wage. Breakfast was served upstairs in the fellowship hall, where volunteers manned the small kitchen and prepared eggs, toast, oatmeal, and cereal. And it was served with a smile, a warm good morning for everyone, and a quick prayer of thanks once they were all seated. Brother Manny, a notorious late sleeper, preferred to delegate the early morning duties at his compound. For the past month, the kitchen had been organized and supervised by Baxter Tate, a smiling young man who'd never boiled water in his previous life. Baxter scrambled eggs by the dozen, toasted loaves of white bread, prepared the oatmeal, real, not instant, and also restocked the supplies, washed the dishes, and he, Baxter Tate, often said the prayer. He encouraged the other volunteers, had a kind word for everyone, and knew the names of most of the homeless he graciously served. After they had eaten, he loaded them into 3 old church vans, drove one himself, and delivered them to their various jobs around Reno. He picked them up late in the afternoon. Alcoholics Anonymous met 3 times each week at Hope Village, Monday and Thursday nights and at noon on Wednesday. Baxter never missed a meeting. He was warmly received by his fellow addicts and quietly marveled at the group's compositions, all races, ages, male and female, professionals and homeless, rich and poor. Alcoholism cut a wide, jagged path through every class, every segment. There were old, confident drunks who boasted of being sober for decades, and new ones like himself who freely admitted that they were still afraid. They were comforted, though, by the veterans. Baxter had made a mess of his life, but his history was a cakewalk compared to that of some of the others. Their stories were compelling, often shocking, especially those of the ex-convicts. During his 3rd AA meeting, with Brother Manny watching from the rear, he walked to the front of the group, cleared his throat, and said, "My name is Baxter Tate, and I'm an alcoholic from Pittsburgh." After he uttered those words, he wiped tears from his cheeks and listened to the applause. Following the 12 steps to recovery, he made a list of all the people he had harmed and then made plans to make amends. It wasn't a long list and was heavily focused on his family. He did not, however, look forward to a return to Pittsburgh. He'd talked to Uncle Wally. The family knew he was still sober, and that was all that mattered. After a month, he began to grow restless. He did not relish the thought of leaving the safety of Hope Village, but he knew the time was coming. Brother Manny encouraged him to make his plans. He was too young and smart and gifted to spend his life in a homeless shelter.
"God has big plans for you," Brother Manny said. "Just trust him, and they will be revealed."
When it looked as if they might escape at a decent hour on Friday night, Tim Reynolds and others quickly organized a drinking party and hurried out of the building. Saturday was to be a rare day off. No member of the litigation group at Scully and Pershing could be seen at work on Saturday because it was the annual family picnic in Central Park. Thus, Friday night was cleared for serious drinking. Kyle declined, as did Dale. Around 7 p.m., as they were both wrapping up the last details of an endless week, and with no one else around, she leaned around the canvas partition that separated their tight cubicles and said, "What about dinner?"
"Great idea," Kyle said without hesitation. "Any place in particular?"
"My place. We can relax and talk and do whatever. You like Chinese?"
"Love it."
The word "whatever" was bouncing around his addled brain. Dale was 30, single, attractive, apparently straight, a pretty lady alone in the big city. At some point, she had to think about sex, though Kyle was depressed at how little he thought about it. Was she picking him up? It was a startling idea. Dale was so shy and reserved, it was hard to believe she would put the move on anyone.
"Why don't you pick up some Chinese and bring it over?" she said.
"Great idea."
She lived alone in Greenwich Village, in a fourth-floor walk-up. They discussed various takeout restaurants in the neighborhood, then left the office together. An hour later, Kyle climbed the stairs with a sack of shrimp and chicken fried rice and knocked on the door. Dale opened it with a smile and welcomed him to her apartment. Two rooms, a den-kitchen combo, and one bedroom. It was small but nicely decorated, a minimalist theme with leather and chrome and black-and-white photos on the wall. She, too, was well-appointed and pursuing the less-is-more approach. Her white cotton skirt was extremely short and revealed more of the slender legs Kyle and the other vultures had been admiring. Her shoes were short heels, open toe, no straps, red leather, high-class tart stuff. Kyle glanced at them and said, "Jimmy Choo's?"
"Prada."
The black cotton sweater was tight, without a bra under it. For the first time in far too many weeks, Kyle began to feel the excitement of sexual arousal.
"Nice place," he said, looking at a photograph.
"$4,000 a month. Can you believe it?"
She was opening the fridge, one about the size of a large desktop computer. She removed a bottle of white wine.
"Yes, I can believe it. It's New York, but no one made us come here."
She was holding the bottle of Chardonnay.
"I'm sorry, but I don't have any club soda. It's either wine or water."
"I'll have some wine," he said, with only a slight hesitation.
And he decided on the spot that he would not torment himself by arguing back and forth about whether he should take a drink after 5.5 years of sobriety. He'd never been to rehab, never been forced to detox, never considered himself an alcoholic. He had simply stopped drinking because he was drinking too much, and now he wanted a glass of wine. They ate on a small square table, their knees almost touching. Even at home and completely relaxed, conversation did not come easily for Dale, the mathematician. He could not imagine her in a classroom in front of 50 students, and he certainly couldn't picture her in a courtroom in front of a jury.
"Let's agree that we will not talk about work," Kyle said, taking the lead.
He took his fourth sip of wine.
"Agreed. But first, there's some great gossip."
"Let's have it."
"Have you heard about the split?"
"No."
"There's a rumor. I heard it twice today. That Toby Rowland and four other partners, all in litigation, are about to split and open their own firm. They may take as many as 20 associates."
"Why?"
"A fee dispute, the usual."
Law firms are famous for exploding, imploding, merging, and spinning off in all directions. The fact that some unhappy partners wanted their own show was no surprise, either at Scully or at any other firm.
"Does that mean more work for the rest of us?" he asked.
"I sure hope so."
"Have you met Toby?"
"Yes, and I hope the rumor is true."
"Who's the biggest prick you've met so far?" She took a sip of wine and thought about the question.
"It's a tough one. So many contenders."
"Too many. Let's talk about something else."
Kyle managed to shift the conversation around to her. Background, education, childhood, family, college. She had never been married. One bad romance still stung. After one glass of wine, she poured another, and the alcohol loosened her up. He noticed that she ate almost nothing. He, though, devoured everything in sight. She pushed the topics back to his side of the table, and he talked about Duquesne and Yale. Occasionally, the law firm would get mentioned, and they would find themselves wrapped up in it.
When the wine and food were gone, she said, "Let's watch a movie."
"Great idea," Kyle said.
As she looked through her DVDs, he glanced at his watch. 10:20.
In the past 6 days, he'd pulled 2 all-nighters, he now owned a sleeping bag, and averaged 4 hours of sleep each night. He was physically and mentally exhausted, and the 2.5 glasses of quite delicious wine he'd just consumed were thoroughly soaking whatever brain he had left.
Romance? Action? Comedy?
She called out as she flipped through what appeared to be an extensive collection.
She was on her knees, the skirt barely covering her rear.
Kyle stretched out on the sofa because he didn't like the looks of either chair. Anything but a chick flick.
How about Beetlejuice?
Perfect.
She inserted the disc, then kicked off her heels, grabbed a quilt, and joined Kyle on the sofa. She wedged and wiggled and snuggled and pulled the quilt over them. And when she was finally situated, there was a lot of contact. And then there was touching. Kyle sniffed her hair and thought how easy this was.
Doesn't the firm have a rule against this sort of thing? He said.
We're just watching a movie.
And they watched it. Warmed by the quilt, the wine, and each other's bodies, they watched the movie for all of 10 minutes. Later, they could not determine who fell asleep first. Dale woke up long after the movie was over. She spread the quilt over him, then went to bed. Kyle woke up at 9:30 on Saturday morning to an empty apartment. There was a note saying she was around the corner at a coffee shop reading the newspapers, so stop by if he was hungry. They rode the subway together to Central Park, arriving around noon. The litigation section of the firm threw a family picnic on the third Saturday of each October near the boathouse. The main event was a softball tournament, but there were also horseshoes, croquet, bocce, and games for the kids. A caterer barbecued ribs and chicken. A rap band made its noise. There was an entire row of iced kegs of Heineken. The picnic was to promote camaraderie and to prove that the firm did indeed believe in having fun. Attendance was mandatory. No phones allowed. For most associates, though, the time could have been better spent sleeping. At least they were not subject to being dragged into the office for another all-nighter. Only Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur afforded the same protection. The day was clear, the weather perfect, and the weary lawyers shook off their fatigue and were soon playing hard and drinking even harder. Kyle and Dale, anxious to avoid even the possibility of gossip, soon separated and got lost in the crowd. Within minutes, Kyle heard the news that Jack McDougal, a second-year associate from Duke, had been arrested the night before when a narc team kicked in the door of his apartment in Soho and found a substantial stash of cocaine. He was still in jail and likely to remain there over the weekend until bail could be arranged on Monday. The firm was pulling strings to get him out, but the firm's involvement on his behalf would only go so far. Scully and Pershing took a hard line on such behavior. McDougal would be laid off, pending the charges. If the gossip turned out to be true, he would find himself unemployed in a few weeks. Kyle paused for a few minutes and thought about Benny. His chilling prediction had come true. Litigation had 28 partners and 130 associates. 2/3 were married, and there was no shortage of young, well-dressed children running around. The softball tournament began with Mr. Wilson Rush, senior of all seniors, announcing the brackets and the rules and declaring himself the acting commissioner. Several lawyers had the guts to boo him, but then anything was permitted on this fine day. Kyle had elected to play, it was optional, and he found himself on a ragtag team with 2 people he'd met and 7 he had not. Their coach was a partner named Cecil Abbott of Team Trilon, who was wearing a Yankees cap and a Derek Jeter jersey, and it was soon evident that Coach Abbott had never run to first base in his life. With a cold Heineken in hand, he prepared a lineup that couldn't beat a decent T-ball team. But then, who cared? Kyle, easily the best athlete, was stuck in right field. In center was Sherry Abney, the 5th-year associate Benny was stalking as Kyle's entree into the Trilon Barton case. As they came to bat in the first inning, Kyle introduced himself and chatted her up. She was visibly upset by the McDougal arrest. They had worked together for 2 years. No, she had no idea he had a drug problem. Mingling was encouraged,
and after Coach Abbott's team was finally saved by the mercy rule in the fourth inning, Kyle plunged into the crowd and said hello to every strange face he encountered. Many of the names were familiar. He had, after all, been studying the bios for 6 weeks. A notorious partner, Birch Mason, also clad in Yankee garb and half-drunk by 2 p.m., grabbed Kyle like an old friend and introduced him to his wife and two teenage children. Doug Peckham took him around to meet some of the partners. The conversations were all the same. Where'd you go to school? How's it going so far? Bet you're worried about the bar exam results. Life gets better after the first year, and so on. And, can you believe McDougal? The tournament was double elimination, and Kyle's team distinguished itself by becoming the first to lose two games. He found Dale playing bocce, and they headed for the food tent. With plates of barbecue and bottles of water, they joined Tabor and his rather homely girlfriend at a table under a shade tree. Tabor, of course, was on a team that was undefeated, and he'd driven in the most runs so far. He had urgent work at the office and planned to be there at 6 the following morning. You win, Kyle wanted to say. You win! Why don't they just go ahead and declare you a partner? Late in the afternoon, with the sun fading behind the towering apartment buildings on Central Park West, Kyle eased away from the party and found a park bench on a knoll under an oak. Golden leaves dropped around him. He watched the game in the distance, listened to the happy voices, smelled the last of the smoke from the grills. If he really tried, he could almost convince himself that he belonged at that party, that he was just another of the many successful lawyers taking a quick break from their hectic lives. But reality was never far away. If he got lucky, he would commit a heinous crime against the firm and not get caught. But if luck went against him, then one day during this family picnic, they would be talking about him the way they were talking now about McDougal. Chapter 23. Sunday, with most of the litigators nursing hangovers, Kyle was up early with a clear head, a tall coffee, walking shoes, and 5 hours to do nothing but hike the city. The firm phone was in his pocket, but the firm phone would not be ringing, because the Sunday after the picnic was a day off as well. A few of the gunners and diehards would be at the office, but most of the firm's litigators would savor another beautiful autumn day without billing an hour. He worked his way south, through the village and into Tribeca, then east into the frenzy of Chinatown. In Soho, he managed to get a seat at the bar at Balthazar, a popular restaurant modeled after a Parisian bistro and raved about in all the guides. He had eggs benedict and tomato juice, and was thoroughly entertained by the rowdy crowd. Then he found the Brooklyn Bridge, climbed to the top, to the promenade, and hiked across the East River to Brooklyn. It took 40 minutes, and then 40 minutes back into Manhattan, where he made his way to Broadway and followed it through the Garment District, the Theater District, Times Square, and on to Columbus Circle. Brunch was at 11:30 at the Upper West Side apartment of Doug and Shelley Peckham. It was an old building on 63rd, 2 blocks off Central Park, and as Kyle rode the stuffy elevator to the third floor, he caught himself doing what most New Yorkers do in their spare time and even while they're working. He pondered real estate. Doug Peckham, as a 41-year-old full equity partner in the firm, earned $1.3 million the previous year. His income was no secret. Scully and Pershing, like most mega firms, published their numbers. Peckham could expect to earn at least that much for the rest of his career, so he could afford a nice place. But $1.3 million a year in New York was not exactly in the big leagues, not even close. The heavy hitters were the investment bankers, hedge fund whizzes, high-tech entrepreneurs, and corporate executives who were worth billions and thought nothing of dropping $20 million for a midtown apartment. And, of course, each had the obligatory weekend home in the Hamptons for the summer and one in Palm Beach for weekends in the winter. The Peckhams had a place in East Hampton. Kyle hoped Shelley and the kids enjoyed the summer house because he knew Doug certainly did not. He was at the office most Saturdays and often on Sundays. Shelley greeted him with a hug, another old friend now, and welcomed him into their open and unpretentious apartment. Doug was in jeans, sockless, unshaven, and pushing Bloody Marys on his guests.
Four other associates were present, all under the supervision of partner Peckham. The brunch was another effort by him and the firm to soften the edges and make Scully seem like a humane place after all. The goal of the get-together was to talk. Doug wanted to hear their problems and concerns, their ideas and plans, their impressions, and their goals. He also wanted to hurry up and finish brunch so they could watch the Giants versus the 49ers and drink beer, kick off at 1. Shelley did the cooking herself, and Doug helped serve and pour the wine. After an hour of useless chatter about the same boring lawsuits they'd slaved over all last week, it was time for the Giants. Kyle, the only first-year associate at the table, contributed less than anyone. Halfway through brunch, he was already planning his return hike downtown. After dessert, they gathered in the den, where a small fire made things cozy, and Doug fiddled with the controls to his high-def, flat-screen TV. In an effort to liven up a dying party, Kyle claimed to be an avid 49ers fan, a hater of the Giants, and this succeeded in generating some trash talk. Two of the older associates were asleep by the end of the first quarter. Doug began to nod off too, and at halftime, Kyle made a clumsy exit and hit the streets. At 5 on Monday morning, he was at the office, digging in for another long week. The Giants' next game was on the road, at Pittsburgh, and 2 hours before game time, Kyle and Joey Bernardo settled into their seats at the 40-yard line and tried to stay warm. A cold front had chased away autumn, and a freezing mist hovered above the new stadium. It didn't matter. As diehard Steelers fans, they had shivered through many games at Three Rivers Stadium, the old place that was gone now. They welcomed the cold. This was real football weather. Mercifully, Blair had little interest in football. Now 5 months pregnant, she had gained an enormous amount of weight and was not handling prospective motherhood too well. Joey was having second thoughts about marriage, but for some reason felt trapped. Kyle had little useful advice. If she wasn't pregnant, he would tell his friend to run. But you can't abandon a pregnant fiancé, can you? It just didn't seem right. What did he know about such matters? As the crowd settled in and the teams warmed up, Kyle was ready to talk. "Speak softly and tell me about Elaine Keenan," he said. Joey had a flask filled with vodka, his antifreeze. He took a swig, grimaced as if it tasted awful, and said, "Nothing but trouble." Their only correspondence about Elaine had been Joey's written summary of his encounter. Kyle needed all the details, and they needed a plan. "She is one bitter young woman," Joey said, "but she's not nearly as mean as her lawyer. Start at the beginning and tell me everything as it happened." Another swig, a good smacking of the lips, a glance around to make sure no one cared, and then Joey launched into a slow, thoughtful, detailed reenactment of his trip to Scranton. Kyle interrupted with questions, but the narrative moved along. Just before the coin toss, with the stadium packed and rocking, Joey finally finished with the admonition, "If they have the slightest opening, they'll attack us with a fury. Don't give them the opening. Let's just bury this little episode." They watched the game for a while and talked about nothing but football. During a timeout, Joey said, "So what's the plan? Can you come to New York next weekend? Steelers Jets, 4 o'clock Sunday at the Meadowlands. I'll get tickets." "Oh boy, I don't know." The problem was Blair, with money also a concern. Joey made a nice salary with commissions, but he wasn't getting rich. Now he had a baby on the way and a wife sometime after that, or vice versa, they couldn't decide. One day Blair wanted to postpone the wedding until the baby arrived so she could regain her figure. The next day she wanted to hurry up and get married so the birth wouldn't be out of wedlock. Joey was just straddling the fence, hanging on by his fingernails and getting whipsawed from both sides. They were now paying for an expensive new condo. He couldn't afford to spend too much watching football.
"Why do you want me in New York?" he asked.
"Because I want to try to get a photo of Benny."
"And why do you want a photo of this guy? These people are dangerous, right?"
"Oh yes, lethal."
"So why are we messing with them?"
"I want to know who they are." Joey shook his head and looked away toward the scoreboard. Then he took a sip and leaned close to Kyle.
"I say we leave them alone. I say you do what they want you to do, play their games, don't get caught, Keep the damned video buried, and life will be good for all of us.
Maybe. Can you come to New York?
I don't know. I'll have to figure it out.
It's very important. Please.
How, old buddy, do you plan?